This is Phil Davidson, and with me today is Rockford Symphony Orchestra Music Director Stephen Larson, and we are discussing the RSO's Classics 4 concert, Scottish Fantasy, on Saturday, February 15th, 7:30 p.m. at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. Well, I like the name of the first piece on this program, Deep Summer Music. It sounds so good in the middle of winter time and all the snow.
That's exactly why we're doing it.
Well, good. Thaw everybody out. It's composed by Libby Larson. Now, that's a good name, and it's even spelled properly.
It is spelled properly, yes.
Yeah. And I think she was born in Delaware, but Minnesota has seemed to have a major influence on her work,
yeah, I believe. Yeah, she's very strongly associated with Minnesota. She did her academic work at the University of Minnesota and has lived there the rest of her life. She co-founded with Stephen Paulus the Minnesota Composers Forum, which later became the American Composers Forum. She's just a very prolific composer, a lot of awards. She's done a dozen operas, one of which, by the way, is named Frankenstein.
Oh.
after our last concert, a little bit of a connection there, perhaps. But a composer who's always kept a lyrical edge to her music and has always written music that connected with people. We've done a couple pieces of hers in the past, and I've always admired her music very much. And I wish I could say I was related to her. I would be honored. But unfortunately, I don't think I am.
You said connecting with the listeners. How so? How does she do that?
She is a tonal composer. We don't have to say that very often anymore because more and more composers are decided that they will not go the atonal route or the serialist route, and instead write in the tonal tradition. Very colorful orchestration, but still with a message that she wants her music to be heard and understood, and yet to be profound enough and deep enough that when you contemplate it, when you think about it, it still resonates. It's not like a pop song that goes into your head and leaves. It's very, very well written music. This piece in particular, I think, is it just speaks so eloquently to the name of the composition, what she's trying to do.
All right. Can you give us some kind of a description of what we will hear in this piece and maybe what Deep Summer is referring to?
It's very local. First of all, Minnesota. We might think of Minnesota as being the North Woods and the land of 10,000 lakes, but a significant part of the Minnesota, particularly the lower part, is part of the Great Plains. Mm-hmm. And this is part of her vision for this piece. Looking out in those sort of endless fields that just go to the horizon of different grains. And she writes that her favorite time of the year is late summer, deep summer, perhaps, if you can call it that, when all of the various grains, the corn, the wheat, the oats, sunflowers, rye, when all of this is ripening and turning colors, the beautiful colors under the summer sky. She writes that it inspires awe in her to look out at and see this. And of course, the effect of the wind rippling through the fields, you get this feeling in this piece of certainly the awe, the wonder at it all. But also there is the textures, particularly in the use of the marimba vibraphone and in conjunction with the strings, you get this sort of rippling effect of the very gentle rippling effect of as if the wind is going through these crops. And it's very difficult to say describe why something, why a piece means something or another, why you feel this way about a particular piece, because there is no book that composers use that says, okay, if you want to write something that sounds like a wheat field, this is what you do. That's impossible. It's all things that we infer from our experience and listening, and perhaps with the help of a little nudge from a title. And that's what happens here. One of the really interesting things about this piece is that it ends after a brief, very sort of melancholic sort of distant trumpet solo. It just stops. There's no final chord. It just runs to the bar line and stops. And, you know, well, what does that mean? Well, I don't know. I mean, I have some ideas what it might mean, but the listeners can fill that in themselves.
Well, then after we go from Minnesota, we move on to Max Bruch's composition, Scottish Fantasy. So we go from Minnesota to Scotland, sort of. But Scottish Fantasy, now that's a shortened version of the title, I believe.
Oh, yeah. The title is, I won't try to do the German, but it's the fantasy for violin, harp, and orchestra, freely taken from Scottish melodies.
oh my gosh!
And so that's a bit of a mouthful. It's in English or in German. The German is such a wonderful language. You know, the title, one of the words in the title is Benutzung, Benutzung, which means use.
Oh my gosh!
It's a title that probably is not used very often, and certainly we're not going to use it. We're just going to call it what Bruch generally called it, which was the Scottish Fantasy. Later on, he called it his third violin concerto on Scottish melodies, but it really isn't a concerto, but it's Scottish Fantasy is good enough for us.
Well, now, Bruch was a child prodigy, I believe. I think if I read properly, he composed in virtually every medium.
Oh, he did. He was primarily known in his lifetime as a choral composer, very popular choral composer. He was 5 years younger than Johannes Brahms, and he was friends with Brahms. And in a lot of ways, their careers were very, very similar. Brahms, too, we don't think of Brahms as being a choral composer, but he wrote a lot of choral music, particularly in the middle part of his life. And in fact, Bruch was always somewhat jealous that Brahms' choral music was better known than his. But he wrote a little bit of everything, a lot of songs, instrumental work, chamber music. He tended to write different periods, different things in different periods of his life, not all at once. The chamber music came later, the choral music came earlier, the instrumental music sort of in the middle.
Now, when it came to solos in his work, I know it was all about the violin. He apparently was not too thrilled with pianos and cellos for solos.
Yeah, I don't think he's on record as saying he wasn't interested in writing violin concertos or cello concertos. But interestingly, he wrote a couple of very famous pieces for cello. The most famous, probably the piece he's best known for is Quol Nidre, for solo cello and orchestra. So he had no aversions to writing for cello, certainly. Cello concertos weren't a big thing in the middle of the 19th century. There weren't that many. Well, there certainly weren't virtuoso touring cellists like there are today, solo cellists who go around making a career doing that. The first really modern cello concerto is Dvorak's, which was 1892 or something like that, 1890s anyway. So he wasn't terribly interested in it just didn't appeal to him very much. Piano, he wasn't a great pianist, and perhaps that's one reason he didn't write for the piano. He did write at least one concerto for two pianos later in his career, but that was more of a thing somebody was requested of him. It was not something he really wanted to do. So it's not something that interested him terribly. His other writing for piano tended to be, well, of course, accompanying songs and in his chamber works. But in terms of solo literature, he wrote no solo literature for piano, period. No piano sonatas, nothing like that.
Well, now, if we look at the Scottish Fantasy itself, does the music sound Scottish?
Well, it should sound Scottish. It's based on Scottish folk songs. There's a whole bunch of them in there. And I know that Stephen Ledbetter, who's our program notes annotator, doesn't think it sounds particularly Scottish. Well, I do. the opening, as a matter of fact, it has that gloom that Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture has, that sort of you can imagine the craggy Scottish coast with the gray skies and the mist and the wind blowing and things. It has that kind of an atmosphere to it. But later on, quotes several different Scottish folk tunes. And the thing that probably people would know the most about what is Scottish folk music, the Scottish snap, the rhythm of bam, ba-dam, bam, that's the Scottish snap. That occurs a lot, particularly in the last movement, which is based on a very famous Scottish song, Scots Wahé, I think is the way it's pronounced, which was for a long time sort of the unofficial national anthem of the Scots.
Well, now, who's the violin soloist for this performance?
Stefan Milenkovic. He's known him for a decade, 15 years or something like that. Stefan was also a prodigy. At age 10, he played for Ronald Reagan and the White House at a Christmas concert, and he's played for Pope John Paul II and won a whole bunch of competitions. He's really phenomenally talented and phenomenally kind of a laid-back guy. He plays violin with rock groups. He's loves environmental causes and outdoors and things. He's a really interesting guy, Serbian by birth. And he now teaches as an associate professor at the University of Illinois in Urbana.
Oh, well, something to look forward to. Now, on the program, the final piece is Brahms Symphony No. 2. And if I read the information properly, it seems that Brahms didn't compose a symphony, or at least he not allow his symphonies to be performed until he's kind of in the mid-40s. What was that all about?
This is probably the thing that people, if they know anything about Brahms, they probably know this about him, that Brahms was a very serious person. His personality was rather introverted, although very fond of practical jokes. And he, from very early on, was very conscious of Beethoven's, his heritage, the legacy of the Beethoven symphonies, and particularly the Fifth Symphony, which was, by the time he was growing up, was regarded as sort of the model of the Romantic symphony. This is what you had to aspire to. So from the very beginning, he was aware that if he was going to write anything, it had to be as good as Beethoven's. And he had enough self-assurance to think that he could do it, which is kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. He actually composed or started writing his first symphony when he was 19. Nothing came of it except that he ended up incorporating some of it into his first piano concerto. And it wasn't until he was, 43 years old that he finally finished his first symphony. And that first symphony was very much based on Beethoven's Fifth and its form and certainly its seriousness. So it took that long. And during this period, among other things, he was writing a lot of choral music, a lot of vocal music. He was experimenting. He started as a pianist, not knowing a whole lot about orchestration. So he had to learn orchestration. And very patiently, he did some sort of some studies that led up to the symphony. His serenades, the serenade in D major, serenade in A major, these were sort of pre-symphonic works that he wrote to get in practice, to see what it was like to write a large-scale instrumental work. So when he finally premiered the first symphony in 1876, the floodgates opened at that point, and he felt confident he could do it again. So he followed up immediately with the second symphony, the Symphony in D major.
Well, now, if I understand correctly, the early performances of the symphony received mixed notices. Or I think there was one critic that said that he felt that Brahms' music was too intellectual, but I think that's changed in these days.
Well, you got to keep in mind that almost without exception, any great work didn't receive great press in its first performance. They always stretch the audience just a little bit beyond what they thought they could handle. It didn't get universally bad reviews, but it was a little bit puzzling, partially because they were expecting something along the line of the First Symphony. The First Symphony is a lot more direct. It's a lot more dramatic, and ends with that big, huge, triumphant C major ending, just like the Beethoven Fifth did. The second is much more of a pastoral feeling symphony. It doesn't go to those great dramatic heights. It doesn't seem to have pretensions of having a deep meaning like the first seemed to obviously do. But Brahms, with the sense of humor that he had, was writing to friends while he was in the process of finishing the piece, saying, "Oh, you won't believe how depressing this piece is. We're going to print the score with black edging around it. It's going to just like a funeral music. It's just such a downer." Not those words, of course, but and he wrote to another friend, "I'll give you an impression of what my symphony is like. My second symphony is like if you take an F minor chord and you play it fortissimo, and then play it pianissimo, and then play it fortissimo again, and play it for pianissimo, and just keep doing that endlessly. You'll get an idea as to what this piece is like." Well, I'll have to go through and really look at it again, but I don't think there's a single F minor chord in the entire piece. So he knew what he was doing there.
Well, there was one comment that I read about Symphony No. 2. It said, "The parts fit as in a superbly made Swiss watch." So can you comment on that?
Yeah, this is the thing, the thing about Brahms, and particularly the Second Symphony, although you can say it about all of his symphonies, the thing that just continues to amaze musicians. And the more you study this music, the more you see. And Arnold Schoenberg, who, of course, invented the system of serialism, 12-tone writing, claimed that Brahms was a proto-serialist. So he was the original serialist because he did the same methods in his composition, particularly in the Second Symphony, of taking ideas and using them in a very, very systematic, almost scientific fashion. In this piece, in the first 8 bars, he tells you, he uses every bit of musical material he's going to use for the rest of the 45, 50 minutes of music in those first 8 bars. And everything you hear after that is some version of those 3 themes in that first 8 bars, either turned upside down, done faster, slower, done backwards. It's just incredible. And yet you're never aware of it, at least that the first time you hear it, you're not aware that there's anything like this going on. So why did he do that? First of all, as I said, it's transparent. Only after you've studied the score can you really begin to trace that idea, that first bar, that the dee-da-da-dum that the cellos and basses play, that comes back in so many different forms, so many ways during the course of the piece. The effect of the writing is to, well, I look at it like this. If an architect is designing a building, the architect's going to choose materials that are all sort of part of the total image. He's not going to choose things that don't belong or that contrast. Mm-hmm. You look at it and say, whoa, where did that come from? And Brahms, who has got the same 12 notes that any other composer has and the same harmonic vocabulary that any other composer uses, chooses these little essential musical themes to create his entire piece out of, so that the whole piece is one sort of a whole cloth. It's something that people say that Brahms is intellectual because of that, and I guess you can say that he is intellectual because of the process he uses. And some people are a little put off by Brahms' music because they sense a kind of a reserve in it. And that's certainly true. Brahms' music has a bit of reserve, although he lets out a few of the stops in this piece. He really does toward the end of the last movement. There's always the control in this man's work. And rhapsodic or the fantasy-like atmosphere of the Bruch. No, that's not for Brahms. He wants more control over his material, and he really exercises it very well in this piece. This is my favorite Brahms symphony, and it's I've conducted this piece more than any of the other symphonies, so I really feel like I know it better than the others. And every time I come back to it, though, it's different. It's a whole different experience, and I see new things, I hear new things, and I'm always struck in awe. How is this possible? How is something that I've studied for years and years and years, I can still look at the page and still see something new and hear something new that I never heard before?
Well, look forward to this. Let's talk about sound bites.
Okay.
What it is and when the next one happens, and I think we know who the guest will be.
Yes, our soloist, Stefan Milinkovic, and I guarantee you this is going to be a very interesting discussion. Talking about Stefan and his various interests and where he's been and where he's played. And he's a very engaging fellow, and I'm really looking forward to this particular Soundbites. This is, of course, the day before our concert on Friday at noon at the Monatisi Country Club. And it's a very nice situation. You can go and order a lunch there, and the soloist and I sit and talk. And it's not a pre-concert talk. We don't go over the music or talk about the music. We talk about life, the life of a musician, and his life in particular in this case, how he got to where he is, how he feels about music, what he does for fun.
Great. Well, it sounds like we're going to have a fantastic variety of music in Scottish Fantasy, which is the Classics 4 concert by the Rockford Symphony Orchestra at the Coronado Performing Arts Center on Saturday, February 15th at 7:30, of course. For more information about this concert, sound bites, or other concerts or anything, go to rockfordsymphony.com or call them at 815-965-0049. This is Phil Davidson.
And this is Steve Larson, music director of the Rockford Symphony.
Thank you for listening.